I prefer to think about working class conservatism in the modern sense as a set of contingencies rather than as something that naturally flows from the experience of being working class. So we can find historical instances of working class life that were not very sexually repressed, that were not very buttoned down, that we can find lots of instances of periods when working class people were not homophobic or especially homophobic and so on, right? So I hope I keep all of that. God, I sound like an awful academic at this point. It's complex. It is complex, but it's not hopelessly complex.
So hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for being with us. We're continuing the discussion here with Roger Lancaster as part of a discussion or the kind of spin-off discussions from his book, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example, which we've just been discussing on the main show. And now we're going to explore some other topics which are maybe suggested in the book, but maybe don't, you know, aren't the object of the book. So firstly, there's a little bit in the book where you contrast conservatism and how conservatism and particularly social conservatism and particularly around questions of sexuality play out in working versus the middle class in Mexico, but also in the kind of lower working class that you contrast to the kind of the main bulk of the working class.
Yeah. I mean, I take it around a few times because it's hard to escape the idea that there's something about working class life that involves some degree of cultural conservatism, and then that also involves, you know, conservative gender norms and sexual expectations or something like that. I take this around a few times though, and I end up on the conclusion that there's nothing unique about working class conservatism. There's no such thing as working class conservatism per se. Social theorists galore notwithstanding, but rather you get different kinds of contingent pressures of different kinds of conservatism that are distributed throughout society, but sometimes end up being concentrated in working class settings. That's the short of it. I mean, the long of it is, of course, that ideas about working class and peasant, i.e. popular class conservatism, have a very long trajectory in social theory. And there, that's where I started out in 1988 with a book on the Sandinista Revolution and the role of liberation theology in it. And I argued there that popular conservatism gets leveraged under certain circumstances to become a revolutionary force in social movements and political movements and even in some cases, you know, the basis for revolutionary movements. So I kind of feel like I came in on this like many, many years ago. I've probably ended up on a much more modulated version of it now. But of course I'm entering the question from a different angle this time.
Right. I mean, I guess the question of maintaining kind of a stable and orderly life before we get onto the question of the connection to radicalism, but the desire to maintain a stable and orderly life and the way that people maybe perceive following your sexual desire as a threat to that, and right. how that plays out differently for the middle class versus the working class. Because there's many middle class, I mean, I know people or you know, friends and parents of friends in Brazil who maybe in some cases are middle class, and they have very culturally conservative parents who would be horrified if their kid turned out gay or, you know, or indeed are, and they've had to, you know, have had difficult moments within their kind of family relationships. So how have you seen this playing out in Mexico?
Well, let me try to tackle it this way, right? The argument, you'll have lots of editing to do here as I hum, haw, and breathe and so on. The old school theories going back to Max Weber and Karl Polanyi and others is that popular class conservatism builds a hedge against forms of capitalist development and exploit and the intensification of capitalism. So in other words, the time-honored ways of doing things often redound to the benefit of the popular classes, or at least establish limits to what capital can get away with. And that, you know, I don't dismiss that. That's important. I mean, that's where my academic career started, was with thinking along those lines about the Sandinista revolution and the role of moral economy in, you know, animating people's thinking, whether they had literally signed on to liberation theology or not. They clearly had in their head these kinds of ideas that have to do with stability and conservatism, really, right? So there's one angle, and I don't dismiss it. I don't throw out that entirely. Here's what I see happening, though, in the current conjuncture in Mexican working class settings. So the forms of conservatism that I'm thinking about are broadly distributed throughout the middle and even upper classes. So sexual reticence, sexual repression, for want of a better word, heteronormative family values of some sort or another, right? All of these are widely distributed. But they get concentrated in working class settings for a variety of reasons. So the neoliberal period devastated working class moral economies. What happens after that? Well, what happens after that is that new kinds of Catholicism move in, Protestant evangelicals move in, the Jehovah's Witnesses are there in substantial numbers in Mexico compared with their presence in other places. Right. So all kinds of moral reform movements gain attraction precisely in working class, lower working class, peasant, and indigenous communities. And they bring with them, they bring with them the whole package, right? They bring with them very repressive sexual morality. They bring with them, you know, gender expectations that are rather old-fashioned. And I don't, you know, I try to be careful the way I write it. Like there's very good reason why working class people living through turmoil, often who have family members who are alcoholics, who beat their wives, who are out of control under any sense of the, like, there are very good reasons why working class people are often attracted to these movements. These movements promise stability. But some of the stability that they promise, of course, you know, has to do with repression. And that is all right. So there's one angle, right? There's one contingency. So The other contingency is that in Mexico, as in other places, some semblance of higher education is a very good predictor of liberal tolerant, you know, values. But of course, precisely because of the class setup, most working class and peasant, farmer, remote village people don't have access to that. So there's another contingency that clicks in. I prefer to think about working class conservatism in the modern sense as a set of contingencies rather than as something that naturally flows from the experience of being working class. You know, so we can find historical instances of working class life that were not very sexually repressed, that were not very buttoned down, that you know, we can find lots of instances of periods when working class people were not homophobic or especially homophobic and so on, right? So I hope I keep all of that. God, I sound like an awful academic at this point. It's complex. It is complex, but it's not hopelessly complex, right? There's a series of contingencies that bring all of this weight to bear on gay and lesbian youth from working class backgrounds today.
So, I mean, one of the things that you have already mentioned that you started off your academic career looking at the Sandinistas, the role of liberation theology and the kind of relationship between that and a moral economy, with these kind of, I guess, tacit notions of what fair is and or the kind of way that life has been kind of ingrained in certain practices and rhythms and that it's being disrupted by capitalist rationalization. And I guess the argument, I mean, I'm not familiar with your work from back then, but I mean, I thought it might be an interesting time to reflect on it because we've kind of touched on this on some certain episodes, and there's a little bit of discussion going around about whether there's a kind of romantic moment reemerging. And I've always been interested in the theme of romantic anti-capitalism. So I wanted to bring this up here because what I'm getting at, I guess, is that peasants or people who are maybe one generation removed from the peasantry in Mexico, at least until maybe the 1980s, 1970s, 80s, were genuinely, they weren't untouched by modernity, I think. That would be completely wrong to say. But their lives weren't completely wrapped up in the market. You know, the market was there, but it wasn't fully subsumed, I think, in a way that they maybe had a contact with a form of life which they might seek to defend against the incursions of capitalist modernity. And that might provoke, that's conservative, but it might be provocative of a, or might, you know, might be a springboard to radicalism. And I wonder, you mentioned elsewhere in the book about how some in relation to kind of conceptions of mestizo modernity and whatever, how different some of that kind of cultural nationalism, how that cultural nationalism, that argument for Mexican cultural nationalism, which was elaborated in the 1970s, 80s, is no longer relevant to today in a situation which most people work in either in industry and manufacturing or in the service sector and have fully kind of modern or postmodern consumption habits. So I wonder if the basis, whether you think there is a basis still for that kind of conservative springboard into radicalism that maybe once existed.
That's a good question. It's a very long one with a lot of little pieces, and I'm going to try to engage it. And if I don't answer it, you'll tell me and we'll work around and try to figure it out. So look, here's one way in, right? So, you know, under NAFTA, they reformed the Mexican Constitution to remove the constitutional protections for the ejido system. Ejidos are communal farms. So under the old regime, starting with Lázaro Cárdenas, I'm sure, is when it was put in the Constitution, right? Communal land ownership by the municipio, by the municipality, was constitutionally protected, and it could not be privatized. So you could not buy and sell public land, and an awful lot of land was tied up in that, This was the foundation of indigenous identity. So is that fairly, so indigenous villages owned the land around them, and some mestizo villages owned the land around them. And they operated it through usufruct rights, and it was closed. People from outside the community didn't have access. It was corporate in that it was, you know, owned like a corporation, and it was communal, right? So there. This was constitutionally protected in order to get into NAFTA. You know, part of the neoliberalizing impetus was to strike that and get rid of it. No longer constitutionally protected. That doesn't mean that they automatically sold it off everywhere, though, right? I mean, there are places where the ejido lands were privatized and parceled out. And I know people who went through the process of having the land that they had historically worked put in their name, so that you did have a massive privatization of lands that had been public into the 90s and 2000s. But there's still a lot of ejido. There's still a lot of communal lands left. I mean, they haven't all disappeared. There's still indigenous villages rooted in that concept, right? So this has always been kind of a strong basis for a kind of Mexican indigenous communism. So, or socialism anyway, or something, or populism. It blurs political categories, but it, you know, there's a kind of a way of founding yourself in an identity on the land, not as a private owner, but as a communal owner. That, all right, is that still around? That has taken a beating. That has clearly taken a beating. It's still around, but you know, to some extent, one way of interpreting the Zapatista uprising is that the Zapatistas were largely indigenous people who had been thrown out of communal villages, and they wanted basically what the others in the what other communal villages had. They wanted those same kinds of rights. So I noticed that AMLO's proposed constitutional reforms to be considered this year includes establishing new indigenous and Afro-Mexican municipios, which is, this is an interesting path to take. Now I argue that the bulk of the Mexican working class is really, you know, indifferent to that. The bulk of the Mexican working class has left the village, has left indigenous identity, has come to the city. They work in factories, or they work in maquilas, or they work in, you know, restaurants owned by Carlos Slim, or they work in something that we would all identify as modern and industrial or service sector or what have you. But there does seem to be some kind of a nostalgia, and maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to look at the proposal more closely. I've only seen references to it, but if the idea is to try to re-implant corporate communal villages with land ownership and so on, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what I would make of it.
Mm. Well, I mean, the agrarian economy, I guess, is anyway a much smaller proportion of the Mexican economy as a whole.
And it's not really a winner in a way, right? I mean, it's not going to be a strong edge for development or improvement. So I would look, I mean, so, you know, communal autonomy is not a new concept or a radical concept in Mexico. It's been everywhere since the Mexican Revolution. And before that, it was also everywhere, but it was badly eroded under the liberals, right? So does this empower people to take control over their resources and lives, or does it trap them in poverty? I mean, this is the longstanding question about those kinds of villages, right? This is the longstanding debate. Oh. And it could do both, of course. Like, it could do both, but there's your dilemma, right? How do you make it better?
So moving towards the past and more towards the future, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO for short, Mexico's president, he's just serving out the last months of his term now. And you already hinted at the fact that he might be kind of working his way, innovating his way to some different new political model. I mean, we've had, as we already mentioned, you know, the kind of corporatist dirigiste, slightly welfarist model of the PRI, which was authoritarian and pretty socially conservative, and then a kind of move to a more socially liberal but neoliberal settlement, which, you know, increased the rate of exploitation, squeezed the working class and indeed the middle class, increased precarity and so on. And AMLO seems to represent this sort of hybrid of sorts.
Right.
How do you see him?
AMLO is a man of the left, not clearly how far left or which left, but clearly a man of the left who's been in politics since 1988. He was involved in the notorious, you know, year when Cárdenas had the election purloined in plain view. He may have been one of those militants who urged Cárdenas to seize the National Palace as the parade of protesters marched by the National Palace. Unclear. Cárdenas did not seize the National Palace. He's probably right. It probably would have resorted in a bloodbath. At any rate, this is where AMLO comes from that failed attempt of the left-wing coalition to take power in 1988. He ran for president three times before winning. He ran in 2006, a very controversial election. Some would say that AMLO blew it to some extent. Maybe he did. He let charges and accusations and a slimy smear campaign go unanswered for 3, 4, 5 months, so that by the time he started answering, the polls were neck and neck. He had started with a wide lead. It slimmed down. And then the question, like, it looks very much like votes were pilfered here and there to produce a result that deprived AMLO of the presidency, right? So that was, you understand a lot about AMLO's orientation to the media and the establishment if you look at 1988 and 2006. All right. Sometimes he might seem a tad churlish, but he understands very well that the media is not his friends and that the establishment would do in any real reform government if they could. So he ran again and lost to Peña Nieto in 2000. Oh God, what year would that have been? 2012. Peña Nieto could have reestablished the PRI. So the PRI hadn't been out of power for two turns. If Peña Nieto had had a successful presidency, you would have probably had pre-governments for as far as the eye can see again going forward. But instead, it was a disastrous presidency. It didn't accomplish much of what it set out to do. It was mired in corruption scandals and controversies and so on and so on. To his great and everlasting redounding credit, Peña Nieto actually came to the transfer of power in 2018. Like the other people who ran for president did not come to the inauguration. Peña Nieto understood, can't believe I'm saying nice things about Peña Nieto, but he understood the importance of having a peaceful and regular transfer of power. He wanted it to be a regular transfer of power. And so he came to the inauguration and he sat politely while AMLO handed the presidential sash over to a curandero, a witch doctor, to cleanse and purify before putting it on, right? There's great manipulation of the scene, right? AMLO knows very well that most Mexicans probably don't go to curanderos anymore, but their parents or grandparents do or did. And the whole curandero scene is deeply embedded in Mesoamerican civilization. And this was kind of a way of saying, I'm one of you. Like, this is us now. Mm. This isn't them. This isn't those Harvard educated. Well, actually, Peña Nieto wasn't Harvard educated, but most of the rest were. This isn't those people who wear suits and are descended from the Spanish. This is us, right? So he said he struck an incredible note, I think. I've never seen a better campaign than 2018. There was actually an interview. It's called an interview. AMLO sat down for an interview with the press corps, and it ends up being a debate between the press corps and AMLO, right? So there are like 12 members of the press, and they're all giving him hostile questions, and they're all being different. They're all just being little bitches the whole time, right? And you would think he would like lash out at them, or he might show a side of him that would make you think of Hugo Chavez or someone, but he avoids that temptation. And instead he just, in good humor and full self-possession, he debates the entire press corps. And the result was an overwhelming landslide election. So, okay, what has AMLO done since being in power? He had campaigned on a promise to end neoliberalism. Now, that's an ambitious campaign promise. Like, how do you end neoliberalism? There's no master switch that you can pull that would like click and it's over, right? But instead, what he's done is over 6 years, he's like looked at all the little switches and transfer points and nodal places, and he's flicked the switches all across the board for changing the way the system works. And the results are fairly stunning, I think. I mean, real social spending is up a lot. It makes a big difference in people's lives. People have, they'll say a dignified pension. People have pensions that allow them some sense of dignity now, right? And so here you've had 30 years of the working class taking it on the chin. By the time AMLO is elected, I would think it's safe to say that the working class has been totally defeated. It's true that the trade, that the labor unions were a basis of working class power, but historically those were incorporated into the PRI. So any independence that they might have was very limited. AMLO has undertaken to rebuild the working class from the top down. I know it's not supposed to happen that way, and ideally it wouldn't happen that way, but there was not a chance of rebuilding it from the bottom up, at least not at that moment. And so he's been making moves to rebuild a working class movement around Morena, the party that he whipped up out of whole cloth when he broke with the PRD. And we'll see. This is like we're all waiting now. So Claudia Sheinbaum is going to be the candidate for president, and she's doing very well in the polls. She's actually polling ahead of AMLO. She's getting bigger numbers than he ever got, at least in the polls, but polls can be deceptive. So she's trying to build on what AMLO calls the fourth transformation. And she says, we've laid the first floor. Now we're going to build the second floor, of the fourth transformation, which will pivot things more to working class people and the masses, and away from elite control and mafiosi deals and so on, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I don't know if you wanted to add in anything there at the end.
At the end, I see. I think I started out by saying something like, you know, we're not quite sure how far left AMLO really is, because he's a discreet politician. I've seen him give speeches on various occasions, standing next to the PTs, the worker parties, hammer and sickle flags. So he's never been afraid to stand next to a display of communist flags. And when he gave his counter inaugural in 2006, I attended it in the Zocalo of Mexico City. And you know, he gives his speech, he does his spiel, he tells you what his administration, which is not going to take office, is going to do, and so on and so on. And then they brought out Silvio Rodriguez, the Cuban troubadour, to conclude the event. So AMLO has outwitted and AMLO lost for a very long time before he won.
Yeah.
And after he won, building into that 2018 campaign, he outmaneuvered, outplayed, and outwitted an exhausted opposition, because by 2018, things are pretty bad. Like, things are in a shambles. And he built a coalition that I think was unimpeachable. I mean, on the one hand, his coalition partner was the PT, the Worker Party, a classic Leninist left type, not really Leninist because they're you know, electoral, but a communist party. But his other party, his other coalition party, was this weird little small Protestant conservative party, the PES, and so.
Yeah, there's definitely something kind of synthetic there with AMLO, which I think will be like very interesting to keep an eye on, and you know how Morena does if it's able to win re-election. So maybe we should do this. Maybe we should do this again. We plan to do plenty on Mexico, actually, kind of around the election, because we've been remiss in not doing it. So definitely something to do. But this has been fantastic, Roger. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Roger.
I'll do a plug. Can a Jewish physicist win the presidency in Mexico? This is a real question. It appears that she can. She's doing very well.
Excellent.
But this is a cliffhanger for you, right?
That's good. That's good.
Can you prevail with that profile and the right platform?
And if you build a party which has enough support, it'll carry your. I'm getting kind of little flashes of Dilma Rousseff being put forward by Lula as his successor. Though AMLO seems to have it more thought out.
I've always been afraid of what they did in Brazil to AMLO and his successor. I've always been afraid of that.
All right, Roger, thank you very much. And thanks for listeners for tuning in. And we look forward to your thoughts on this episode. And once again, I should plug the book is this for those who are watching, The Struggle to Be Gay in Mexico, for example.
The best looking little book you've ever seen. And by the way, my informants in Mexico give me more street cred for the cover than they do for the fact that there's a book inside of it, because the artist is a famous gay painter in Mexico, Fabian Chaires. He's the guy who painted Zapata in Heels, which triggered riots when it displayed at the Beaux-Arts Museum in Mexico City.